Immersive cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Freshly prepared regional cuisine. Viking sails the rivers of the world and takes travelers to the heart of iconic destinations. Discover more at viking.com.
Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at raymondjames.com/podcast.
I'm Jace Lacob, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. And with a single heartbreaking moment on the beach, Ross and Demelza sail out of our lives forever.
Ross, you will come back.
I swear to you, my love, I will return.
But for the Poldarks of Nampara, some stories are just beginning.
If it's a boy, we'll call him Henry. And if it's a girl?
Isabella Rose.
Ross has taken on the role of spy for King and Country. Demelza is once again an expectant mother. And George, Valentine, and Ursula bid farewell to Trenwith for good.
I came to inform you that I am closing up Trenwith. Henceforth, Truro and London will be my home.
I see.
Series creator, executive producer, and head writer Debbie Horsfield crafted the final Poldark sequence on the Cornish beaches on her own. But that doesn't mean she didn't have any regrets wrapping up the beloved period drama.
I've never got bored of the books. I just love them and think they're brilliantly written and the characters brilliantly evoked. And I sometimes glance up at the books on my bookshelf now and think, ugh, you know, I'm not reading those today.
Horsfield joins us on our final Poldark episode, and together we say goodbye to the swashbuckling, ore-mining, romance-strewn Masterpiece series. And later, my Masterpiece colleague Barrett Brontis, co-host of our companion podcast Mining Poldark, speaks with the original Ross Poldark, Robin Ellis, about that surprising final scene between his Reverend Dr. Halse and Aidan Turner's Ross. And this week we are joined again by Poldark creator, executive producer, and head writer Debbie Horsfield. Welcome.
Hello.
There's a time jump of 5 months at the very start of the final episode, which pushes us into the heart of Ross's covert plan to stop the French invasion. Ross and Demelza are fracturing because of Ross's plan, one that puts him into the arms of Tess Tregeddon. Did you feel the need to push these two apart one last time before they could devote themselves to each other completely at the end of the series?
I think it's very typical of Ross to do something which obviously is out of love for Demelza. It's to protect her. But as usual, he doesn't fully think things through, and he always hopes for the best. And as usual, the best doesn't always happen. So, yes, I think it was necessary that we had to have that kind of fracture in the relationship, if only for, you know, for a few minutes in the episode, a misunderstanding, the wrong assumptions. And given, obviously, given their history together, it was easy for her to jump to conclusions.
I don't want to lose you, Ross.
You fear that?
Sometimes. Of late, more oft. Wondering where you go.
I have a mind to run.
Why you're gone so long.
Would you rather I was in London?
As to that, you may as well be, since Hansen and Merceron pursue us here.
They're of no consequence.
Why do I misdoubt that?
Perhaps you misdoubt everything I say.
Do I have cause?
No. No cause.
But yeah, I think we did need one final fracture before they actually reconnected fully and set off on the next part of their journey together.
Demelza learns of Ross's scheme and goes so far as to insert herself in the secret meeting between Ross and General Toussaint. Is this completely reckless, or is it just Demelza being Demelza and saving Ross?
Well, it is reckless, but, you know, the stakes are very high. They haven't really been any higher. And she is obviously thinking, what other option does she have? Because she knows that Ross is heading for disaster. And she's also a quick thinker. And she's also very aware that she is, you know, she can charm people. That has been one of the things about Demelza throughout all the books, is that she is very charming when she wants to be. So that's a weapon that she has no qualms about using in extreme circumstances.
And I do love the fact that it's Demelza's arrival and her very, very quick thinking that actually saves Ross, because without her, he surely would have been killed by Toussaint and
yes.
Ralph Hansen.
Sir, from the bottom of my heart, I bless you. Can you truly think to rid me of this fiend?
You do not plead for him?
Plead? I loathe him.
What?
He's a liar and a bully. He repeatedly breaks his marriage vows and my heart. So yes, I despise him. It would be a blessed release if you were to dispatch him.
Delighted to oblige you, madam.
But not too swiftly. I should like to see him humiliated before his dispatch.
Nothing would give me a greater pleasure.
Is it a fitting balancing of the scales that these two have saved each other?
Yes, I think that was the intention of it, really, is that they have throughout the series sometimes let each other down, sometimes redeemed themselves, sometimes redeemed each other. But finally, Demelza steps in and redeems Ross in the most exceptional way, because, as you say, otherwise, there would have been a bullet through him.
I do love that we get a redemption of sorts for George Warlegen, who performs his patriotic duty by coming to Ross's rescue and killing Toussaint and injuring Ralph Hansen. What's behind his about face and the reveal of his true colors?
George has always been the bad guy, except that he hasn't always really been. He has shown signs of humanity and occasionally of decency. And I've always felt that from way back he rather admired Ross and would have wanted nothing more than to be Ross's friend. And that was something that was never going to happen, because the two of them have such diametrically opposed views of humanity and the world. And so they're never going to be mates. And it's not even really an attempt on George's part to be Ross's friend again, because he knows Ross is never going to accept the hand of friendship. And yet there is a spark of decency in George, and I personally don't think it's just because he feels it's his patriotic duty. That's kind of the excuse he puts on it. But I just felt that he couldn't live with himself if he knew that, you know, Ross was going to his death and he could have prevented it. And also, it's such a surprise that it's, you know, who could resist that little kind of twist of drama?
It's an amazing surprise. I love the scene between them over the glass of brandy. They agree to resume their animosity.
Clearly, we are never going to be the best of friends.
Or any manner of friends.
But I believe thanks are in order.
Spare yourself. The gesture was not out of concern for you, but out of loyalty to my country.
I'm indebted to you nonetheless, which is not a position I relish.
Whereas I revel in it.
So, shall we revert to our usual animosity?
With pleasure.
But there is embedded within that this acknowledgement of very begrudging, perhaps, but mutual respect.
I think so. I think the animosity has always been more on George's side, and it does continue pretty much to the end of the books. I think that although Ross would never want to be George's friend, could never see himself as George's friend, he doesn't nurse grudges in the way that George does. So in a way, he kind of has to let George have the resumption of hostilities, because he knows they're never going to operate in any other way.
George later visits Nampara to tell Ross and Demelza that he's closed up Trenwith, and asks that they forbid Valentine from visiting them, as he's, quote, not a relation. Is this the closest we get to George somewhat acknowledging the truth of Valentine's parentage?
Well, nobody knows the truth of Valentine's parentage, to be fair. None of our characters could possibly know the truth of Valentine's parentage. In the book, Winston Graham, as the narrator, makes it clear that Ross is Valentine's father, but none of the characters know that, and there was no way for any of them to know it for certain. So Ross doesn't know it. I mean, people can suspect it. George may suspect it. Ross may suspect it. The villagers clearly suspect it, as evidenced in the later books. But there is no proof, and Winston Graham is clear that none of the characters know it for sure.
Ross duels with Toussaint. The Carnes and Zaki capture the French hiding in Wheel Leisure. And during the most taut double sequence in Poldark yet, Loveday Carn is born.
Yes.
My love.
We have a daughter.
Daughter.
And you're safe. All is well.
All as we'd hoped. What a day. What a love. That's what we'll call her. Love Day.
Love Day gone. Welcome, Love Day.
Does Love Day's birth signal the beginning of a new era for Morwenna and Drake?
Yes, although in Book 8, they don't really appear. But their story just seemed to beg to be to have some kind of conclusion to it. Obviously, Morwenna hideously traumatized from her marriage to Whitworth, and yet clearly it's not easy to get over that kind of trauma. They can't just get married and live happily ever after. So obviously what we've done is really trace her very slow healing and recovery through this season five. And the birth of Loveday really is almost the signal that redemption is complete. It's always a very, you know, it's a very happy event to end a series with. It is a symbol of new beginnings and fresh hope.
I mean, likewise, Demelza announces her own pregnancy. I mean, it does feel like this final episode isn't building to resolution, but more, as you say, to sort of a series of unseen new beginnings. Was that the intent going in when writing this?
Yeah, very much so, because there are, as I say, there are five more books, and one of the things that we knew we had to do was to not put anything in this season that would contradict or conflict with the remaining five books. So even if those five books never get dramatized and adapted, there is still nothing in our season five which would conflict with things that happen in those later books. But obviously it's the finale season, so you do need a resolution of sorts, but there are also open-ended questions.
George's final scene has him watching as Trenwith is closed, and he gets one final glimpse at his beloved Elizabeth as she enters the house. What was behind this final vision, and is there a sense that Elizabeth is finally at home, finally at peace, at least within George's mind?
I think the sense was that although George appeared to have laid her ghost to rest, at the back of his mind, he probably never will do that. So it's just a fleeting glimpse. It's not a suggestion that his madness is going to resume, but it's an indication that she will always be in his heart.
I mean, he says to Carrie, there will be no other women.
Yeah.
He will remain just wedded to his memory of Elizabeth.
Although in Book 8, and later on, he does meet somebody, and he actually goes on to be married and to have more children.
Dwight and Caroline finally confront the death of their own child, Sarah, and begin plans to try again. It's a scene that invokes Kitty Despard as much as it does Caroline's terror of becoming pregnant and losing another child. Is this a much-deserved happy ending for the Ennises?
I think it's the beginning of a new beginning, because the way Caroline dealt with the death of Sarah was she, for a long time, just denied it and, you know, threw herself into a social life, partying in London. She did begin to confront the loss, but it was clearly too painful for her to do so. And so, you know, in our story, she kind of, in a way, looks for reasons to keep Dwight at a distance. And there's a perfect excuse her believing that Dwight is growing fond of Kitty. Because obviously Dwight has form in this regard, you know, looking back to season one where he had an affair with a married woman. So Caroline has the perfect justification for keeping him at arm's length and doesn't realise why she's doing it for quite some time. But when she finally does, there is, I think, a lot of hope for the Ennises. And again, more spoilers, but they do go on to have more children.
Dwight and Ross both make plans to head to France. Ross to covertly spy on the French troops and Dwight to study with a prominent doctor, but really to keep an eye on Ross, forever brothers in arms. Was the intent to keep these two best friends together in the end?
Yeah, absolutely, because obviously their friendship has come under a lot of stress with the introduction of Ned Despard, which threatened to drag Ross. As is said in one of the middle episodes, if Despard falls, he takes Ross down with him. And Dwight has been endeavouring throughout the series to stop that happening because he can see that Ross is so susceptible to following Ned into all kinds of recklessness. So with Ned out of the way, at least they can be comrades in arms again. And, you know, Dwight values that, I think, and vice versa.
I mean, do you see Poldark ultimately as a story of romantic love as much as it is about the brotherly love between Ross and Dwight and the bond that these two men share?
I think it's about many kinds of love. Obviously, romantic love and sibling love, filial love, parents and children, best friends, the love that someone can have for their employees, for instance. Ross demonstrates great care for the people that he employs. He has great care for some of his old friends that he's known since childhood. It in a way, it kind of shines a light on all kinds of love.
Merceron and Ralph Hansen get their comeuppance. Is it fitting that it's the two Ross Poldarks, Aidan Turner and Robin Ellis, that seal their fate?
Yeah, I mean, that was deliberate. I always knew that I wanted Robin Ellis to come back and be in at least one episode. You know, he's been in every season so far, and it just was, it was a lovely moment when they were both in the same room sealing the fate of the two villains and, you know, having a handshake together as if to say, job well done.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors.
Ocean voyages, expeditions, river journeys. Viking is dedicated to bringing travelers closer to the destination, offering a small ship experience and a shore excursion in every port. Learn more at viking.com.
Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. At what point in the writing of this final season did you know what the final scene of Poldark would be?
I knew that it would be Ross embarking on his first official mission for the Crown. So given that it was Cornwall and it was, a coast, it was always going to be Ross on a beach saying goodbye to Demelza on a headland and then getting a boat out to sea. I knew that it would be that. I didn't really know what the content of it was particularly. And I only really hit upon, the dialogue for it at the last minute. But, you know, when he turns to Demelza and says, I will return, I did kind of have a little smile because, you know, he might well return one day to our screens.
That final scene between Ross and Demelza, the two hearts, one beat, might just be my favorite of the entire run of Poldark.
Are you afraid?
Of course I'm afraid. Every moment of every day.
And I.
We mustn't be. Where's our faith? Where's our gratitude? We're here, we're alive, we have blood in our veins.
And the past is gone. Tomorrow
doesn't exist. All that matters is now.
And we. Two hearts. One beat. Can't ask any more than that. There isn't any more to ask.
There's such a sense of longing and hope, as well as uncertainty about the future, that's embedded within their dialogue. I mean, how difficult was it to actually write this scene out?
Interesting that you should pick that scene out, because those lines actually were the final lines in season four, the last scene. And the sense of them is taken from the end of The Angry Tide. And for all kinds of reasons to do with length of the episode and emphasizing certain elements of the story, that section was taken out of season four. And I was really gutted that we'd lost it. And then I thought, you know what? I can still use those lines. Because they were just so important in the book, in The Angry Tide, and I was really distressed that we couldn't use them at the end of season four, and I thought they would make the perfect ending to season five, because the impulse and the emotion and the commitment to each other is still the same, and it just fitted really beautifully.
We've touched upon the fact that there is a sense, given the way that Ross heads to the boat and looks at Demelza, that this story could very well continue in some fashion in the future. The door has been left open for a possible continuation. Would you ever consider adapting those books and doing another run?
Clearly, it could continue because there are five more books worth of stories. I don't think anyone at this point is thinking about doing that. Having said that, everybody has absolutely loved being involved with this entire five series. And as I've said previously, none of us would ever say never, but as things stand, there are no plans.
What will you miss most about the world of this show?
Well, I probably... I've made really good friends with a lot of the cast, and I will continue to see them. So, in one sense, I won't miss that. But I certainly will miss. I've loved doing the adaptation, and I've loved. I would get into a kind of. I wouldn't say a routine because that makes it sound mundane, but there would always be an excitement when I got up every morning and got into my office and thought, what pages am I adapting today? Because I've never got bored of the books. I just love them and think they're brilliantly written and the characters brilliantly evoked. And I sometimes glance up at the books on my bookshelf now and think, ugh, you know, I'm not reading those today. So just the whole process of writing, and then the script meetings, and the refining of the scripts, and the watching every stage of it from the casting through to the filming through to editing. It's been my life for nearly six years, and I certainly miss that. It's been the most wonderful journey, and I think we're all immensely grateful that we've been allowed to continue it as long as we have.
Debbie Horsfield, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Robin Ellis never saw a fifth season of his original Poldark in the 1970s. His masterpiece adaptation ran for two seasons and aligned neatly with the first four seasons and seven novels covered in this more recent series. But he did get the chance to come back to Cornwall to play the Reverend Dr. Hulse this time around, serving as a kind of Easter egg for fans in the know. He also co-hosted our companion podcast, Mining Poldark, with my colleague Barrett Brontis, and the two of them spoke about the uncanny act of saying goodbye to Ross Poldark for a second time.
Where I'd like to start is wondering, what is it like for you to be saying goodbye to this series again? It's actually, in fact, although it's for the first time for many of us, and not all of us, because there are many fans of both the original Poldark series and this series who have been tuning in the whole time. But this is, in fact, your second Poldark goodbye. So what did it feel like wrapping up on the second iteration of Poldark?
Well, I've sort of learned not to say goodbye, really, because you never know.
Nice.
As Aidan says, you know, in 40 years' time, I mean, 40 years' time, it's stretching it a bit, but he'll be playing Dr. House, and I'll be playing the violin in forever. But anyway, no, I mean, Poldark pursues me, luckily. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful. I've had 40 years of Poldark, and I just never tire of it. And so, yes, it's sad to see this series end, of course, for people, because it's a great story, and we'll talk about that, and a great characters, and you get very involved with it. And so when something that you enjoy so much comes to an end, it's a disappointment. But I you know, Poldark never dies, basically. It is extraordinary. It has a very long life, and who knows. So I'm not saying goodbye to it, I'm just saying au revoir.
There's so much in this final series of Poldark, but not among the top moments, not just of season five, but the whole series overall, is this wonderful scene that we're treated to at the very end.
This really not wait till morning. Trust the matter is significant.
Possession of brandy on which the duty has not been paid.
Is that the charge? Mm-hmm. You realize that being in possession of smuggled goods is a serious offense.
Do not lecture me on the law, sir. Do you not know who I am?
No, sir. Who are you?
A magistrate.
Then I wonder you are so ill acquainted with the law as to hold it in contempt. You will reside in Truro Jail until the case comes to court.
What case? I'll give you a dozen names who'll have us released before you can say...
Ned Despard. Sir. The list of charges.
Bribery, corruption, fraud, blackmail, false witness, mistreatment of prisoners, murder.
Will it be enough to detain them?
For a considerable time.
Your servant, sir.
And yours, sir.
That's just like pure fan service and pure gratification. Just a real gift with a beautiful bow. So what... Did you love that scene as much as I did? And yeah. I want to know everything. So just tell me everything, please.
Well, I did. I mean, when I read it, I thought, well, this is a real... I mean, I think they had difficulty fitting me into the last episode. Because basically, House isn't very central to the whole thing. So anyway, Debbie did a fantastic job. And in the end, it turned out to be, you know, for the idea of House and me being in it, it turned out to be a lovely denouement, a lovely ending to to that kind of very, very background story. But it had its own... sweetness about it, and so I was very much looking forward to playing it. And I arrived very early, actually, in the morning, because I was called first thing, and you get there at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's pretty bleary. And we didn't get to our final bit until the afternoon, by which time, although I'd been sitting down, I was fairly weary. Anyway, I had this scene where I come on, there's very little rehearsal. In fact, there's no rehearsal, really. And you come on and you kind of have to get it together. And in a sort of ironic way, House was in a non-prepared state, which in a way was quite convenient. I mean, you know, he had difficulty finding his wig. Unfortunately, I found it, so I had to put it on. But anyway, he comes in a very flustered state and very upset that he'd been disturbed, etc. And we have this little scene, and there's one line in this scene. I really, truly tell everybody who's listening that I did work very hard on this scene. I learnt my words, but I had real difficulty remembering this line. Then one of them says, "I am a magistrate." And Hal says, "Then I wonder you are so little acquainted with the law as to hold it in contempt." That is my line. And could I remember it? I could not remember it. It was, you know, I was, then I wonder, contempt, by, could we go that? Could we go again, please? Then I wonder you are so, so sorry. I'm so sorry. No. What? One more time, please. Then I wonder you are so ill acquainted I'm so sorry. And in the end, I did it about 10 times, I think, and I almost gave up. I said, well, look, you know, I'm sorry. I threw in the towel. And you watch it now, and it's as though that hadn't happened at all. It's seamless. It's extraordinary how the technical side really helps you out. So that was a bit hairy, but the moment when we shook hands and smiled at each other was a very genuine, sweet moment of ending this very nice conceit of the two Poldarks being together, as it were, in the same scene, which was the same as the first scene in the courtyard. So anyway, in the courtroom. So it was fun, and everybody cheered, and and it was just one of those lovely moments in my acting life. So I appreciate it very much. I appreciate Debbie doing it.
It's a very Reverend Hall scene. He's scolding his audience for not properly knowing the rule of law, you know, and he's threatening others with the full weight of the British legal system. Was that great fun? Did you enjoy this character a lot?
I did. It was terrific to play this. And it's always fun to play those slightly negative characters. And I haven't played all that many of them. So it was fun. It was quite stressful because I had one or two scenes, maybe mostly one scene every series. So, you know, you arrive in the morning, and as I explained, and it's over by the evening, and it's gone in a flash. But the pleasure really was manyfold. I mean, the pleasure was doing it, of course, and reconnecting with this fantastic series and storylines and characters, but also working with this group of people who are, you know, one of the pleasures of being an actor is working with groups of people. I've done it a lot in the theatre and in television. And when it's a series, in the old days, you really were a group, you really were a company, and because it was done slightly differently. But they've managed this time to replicate that and be, the atmosphere was absolutely like a company. And also, they were incredibly good at what they did. I mean, it really is an impressive cast. And so it was a pleasure to rejoin with them every time and just in the green room, just sort of catch up with them while we all waited to go on and things. So it was great. It was fantastic.
You've done so much different work over the course of your career, and Poldark was a really important span for you and project for you, right? I mean, it really, you went on a journey in Poldark. And I'm wondering, did you ever think as this was closing and you were completing this last scene with Aidan Turner, did you sort of look at him and think, here's a young man who's had this role and who's been on a real journey as well, and sort of just like, look at him and sort of knowingly smile like, I've been there too. I have this, I wonder what's in store for him in his future. He has a nice future. Like, did any of that ever?
Yes.
Did you ever
I
feel
think,
that way?
Yeah. I think the part for me certainly was, it was the first time I'd been on BBC One, for instance. I mean, I've been on BBC Two and ITV in individual things and classic serials on WGBH Masterpiece, actually. Quite a few, but nothing like this, which was, you know, popular television Sunday afternoon, in fact, you know, really, really popular stuff watched by a pretty constant increasing audience every Sunday. And that had never really occurred with me, you know. So it was, it was a watershed in my career. And I think for Aidan, you know, he was a well-known actor before he did this, but he'd never done that kind of popular television. He'd done his films. He appeared as I did in costume drama and stuff like that, but nothing like this. And this kind of, you know, this is a long do. This is however many, 35 episodes, isn't it, or more? More actually. That's a lot to appear in every 6 months, every Sunday evening. You know, that's a that really brings you into the public domain. And nowadays, of course, it's different. The with all the social media and stuff, it's sort of a constant repeat of that image goes on all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was pretty strong when I was around, but now, I don't know, it's 10 times as much as that. So it establishes him hugely. And because he was so good in it, you know, and so I don't know, powerful in it, it's going to make a huge difference to his future. So we both have a lot to thank Ross Poldark for. I'm often asked what I think, you know, Poldark, why it's so popular. Why is it that it continues to be so from the very start, and two television series experiencing the same kind of really popular reaction. And it made me think of Richard Morant, who was the original Dr. Ennis in the first go-round. Some years ago, the BBC did a series of programs called The Cult of Sunday Night, which examined, it were half-hour programs of just examining each of the sort of early 70s, 80s series that showed on Masterpiece as well, I think. And he was asked this question: why did he think it was so popular? Why did he think, what was the attraction? And I'd just like to read you what he said, because it just sums it up for me. He said, it's about love, it's about betrayal, things that hurt us, things that give us joy. Like any kind of creation where people you know are going through their emotions, expressing their feelings of love, life, and death, it evokes strong attachments, strong passion, and you love it. You love them, you love the people, you cherish them, you honor them, you respect them.
Oh.
And I thought that was just wonderful, really simple, and absolutely what it's about. That's why it's attractive.
That was Mining Poldark's Robin Ellis and Barrett Brontis. You can hear their entire 5-season recap podcast at pbs.org/miningpoldark or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Coming up next on Masterpiece, a special television broadcast premiere of the original Masterpiece film, The Chaperone, written by Downton Abbey creator Julian Fellowes and starring Downton Abbey's own Elizabeth McGovern.
Here's Mrs. Carlisle come to talk about your trip to New York.
Of course. Hello, Mrs. Carlisle. Sorry about your arm, it looks sore.
She's never heard of Dinichon.
Never mind that. What do you hope to do when we get to New York?
I don't know. I like good theater.
Well, that's something. I think we're gonna have a wonderful time.
That's Sunday, November 24th, exclusively on Masterpiece on PBS. Next year on Masterpiece Studio, we'll welcome the thrilling new series Sanditon to the screen with a new interview with series star Rose Williams. This magnificent adaptation of Jane Austen's tragically unfinished final novel comes to Masterpiece screens on January 12th, 2020. Stay tuned. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Alicia Baitoup is our editor. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust.